Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Rick Takahashi, and he'll be answering your most important questions on midge secrets. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Rick a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box there to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Rick Takahashi about midge secrets. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida and the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. And if you're already a member, go ahead and send them a donation. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Rick, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On our drawing, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have 2 chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Rick's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Rick Takahashi's latest book, Modern Midges, courtesy of Stackpole Books. Want to learn more about Stackpole Books? Go to www.stackpolebooks.com. Lots of great books on fishing. So here's how you can win Rick's book. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills. Our guest tonight is Rick Takahashi. Rick Takahashi loves to tie and design fly patterns for the waters he fishes. Rick has been tying flies since the age of 8. After taking apart his first fly, Arroyo Coachman, and seeing the hackle and wind, he knew he wanted to learn how to tie flies. A couple years later, Rick's uncle bought him his first flying tying kit, and he's been tying ever since. Rick has used his talents to bring others into the realm of fly tying. He is a demonstration fly tier, often displaying his skills at local and regional venues, such as the Denver Fly Fishing Show, International Sportsman's Exhibition, the Federation of Fly Fishers Conclave, and at various regional fly shops near Denver. He is an illustrator and contributor to Fly Fisherman magazine. His art has been used for the Federation of Fly Fishers Conclave, and he's working on a presentation of midge fly fishing for his local Trout Unlimited chapter. Rick has written his first book, Modern Midges, Tying and Fishing the World's Most Effective Pattern, with his fly fishing partner and co-author, Jerry Hubka. Rick's goal is to share with others all of the various aspects of fly fishing and fly tying he's learned. He says, "It's the teacher in me that wants me to share knowledge on an activity that has meant so much to me." Rick is a retired art educator and former art department chairperson at Rocky Mountain High School. He teaches a fly tying course for Angler's Roost and makes his home in Fort Collins, Colorado with his wife Susan, daughter Haley, and son Josh. Rick, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Good evening. Thank you for inviting me on your show.
Oh, it's good to have you. Well, we've got lots to talk about, and we just had a load of questions come in, Rick, and you've seen some of those questions already, and our listeners have outperformed themselves again and submitting questions, which is wonderful. That's what the show's all about. You know, we've kind of got where we had questions are, you know, what are midges in the first place? We'll talk about that. A lot of questions on flies themselves, what kind of flies work, how to tie them, and so forth. A few questions on equipment, a lot of questions on rigging, how to rig up, you know, two flies, one fly, wet, dry, dropper, hopper kind of situation. So lots of things to talk about there. And then, of course, strategies and tactics. How do you actually fish these effectively and get the most out of them? And a few questions on still water. So we've got lots and lots to go through. We better get into it here, Rick, in short order, huh?
I'm ready.
You're ready. Okay. Well, Jack in Lulling, Louisiana, starts us off with probably a very good question here. I'm a newcomer to the sport, so my question is, what is a midge? So can you tell us what a midge is, Rick?
Well, a midge in very, very simple terms is an insect that's very, very similar to a mosquito. In fact, it's in the species of a dipter, which is a true two-wing insect. And the midges are very, very small insects, and they're commonly called chironomids. And so we generally refer to midges as being chironomids. So if you hear that term, we're talking about midges in both still water and in rivers and moving water.
Tell us about the life cycle of the midge and its importance to us as fly fishers.
Yeah, the basic life cycle of the midge is a complete metamorphosis in that it goes from an egg, which is not very important or not important at all to the fly fisherman, the larva. And then from the larva it goes into a pupa, and from the pupa it goes into an adult. And in our book, we have Jerry and I have added a couple of what we call transitional phases. We've added emergers. Those are the pupa that are starting to emerge to the surface to become adults. And then we talk about cluster of flies, and that's after the pupa has turned into a adult, returned to the water, and are bunched together. So we added those. They're not part of the life cycle, but they certainly are very important to the fly fishermen. So we found the need to add that.
You know, the larvae live in weeds and the gravel, and where do they?
Yeah, generally you will find the larvae as the midge, the egg sails to the bottom of the river or the lake. You will find that the larva lives at the bottom or the benthic layer of the watery environment. And a lot of times you will find those larvae in silt and very low oxygenated water. And one of the characteristics that we've noticed, both Jerry and I have noticed in our collecting some of the insects, is that those larvae that live in that silt, low oxygenated water, are red in color, and that's because they store oxygen in the form of hemoglobin in their body, thus they're red in color, and they very much look like a worm, or a piece of thread more accurately. We have encountered people calling these larvae an annelid, and an annelid is an earthworm, if you will, an aquatic earthworm. And sometimes they interchange that name of being an annelid, but it really is not an annelid. It is the larva. And then from that stage, and the larva you'll generally find closer to the bottom. They will get into behavioral drift, especially when you have increases in water. You'll see some of that bottom area being disturbed, and you'll see a lot of the larvae in the behavioral drift. And then they go back and they molt into a pupa. And a pupa is, we feel, a very, very important stage in the midge life cycle. And if you look at our book, you will see that a greater majority of the patterns are pupa. And then from there, they ascend to the surface and become adults. And that's the general life cycle of the midge.
Okay, I have a couple questions for you about this. And
sure.
The first one actually is from Bob in Lafayette, Louisiana. He says, okay. Are red midges similar to bloodworms or San Juan worms? And I think that's what you were just talking about. But
yeah, that annelid is a San Juan worm. Excellent pattern to fish, and you should fish those. But really, the larva is a, I guess for a better term, a bloodworm because of that red coloration. But they're not just limited to red. The bloodworms, I was just stating that we've seen bloodworms not only in red, but we've seen them in cream, white, olive, tan, kind of a white color, but the majority that we've witnessed and have collected have been red.
Okay, but when we say blood worms, is that just kind of like a common name for these larvae? They aren't really worms, as you've just said, right?
Yeah, I would venture to say that the blood worms, they may be talking more about the San Juan worm.
Right.
More
right.
So than the larva.
Right.
But it depends on what locale you're in. I've seen people who have named it a blood worm, and they were talking about the larva. And then in some areas where they've said a blood worm, and they were talking more about an aquatic earthworm.
Okay. So the proper terminology, if the proper, is a larva. Now, the larva, do they start to metamorphosize out of their location then in the sand or whatever, or the silt, and then as they rise to the top, they're in this change into the pupa? Or do they stay a pupa for quite a long time?
What we've seen and what Dr. Brian Chan, who is the entomologist who consulted with us on the book, he talks about the larva going to the bottom into the silt in a case, building a case, and then they will mature into or mold into the pupa. And that from that stage, and it could vary, there's an opportunity for the midge to be what we call a multi-brood, that there's not just one hatch of midges and that's it, that they keep reproducing that themselves, and so you have the midges available to the trout on a year-round basis. And so what we find there is that when the pupa are ready to become adults, they will ascend to the surface of the in the water column, and oftentimes we've captured samples of those midge pupa both in rivers and still waters, lakes. And one of the things that we've seen is that the pupa will oftentimes put a gaseous substance into their body to help them ascend to the surface, to make them a little bit more buoyant going to the surface. And that little gas bubble, if you will, really makes the pupa shiny. So I think that's why a lot of times you will see pupa patterns and some midge patterns tied with bright colors. And so we try to mimic that too. In Ralph and Lisa Cutter's Bugs of the Underworld, they have an excellent piece on the midge ascending to the surface, and they show also the larva in the water swimming around. And as the pupa goes to the surface, there's a couple things that Jerry and I noticed and that we commented on. Is that the pupa wiggles to the surface, and sometimes their movement was a little bit faster than we originally thought. We originally thought that they moved very slow, and I think they move very slow, but also swim fairly fast. And to me, the breathing gills were really prominent in the pupa ascending to the surface. And we also witnessed the pupa attaching its posterior at the rear end to the surface, so it created a kind of like a little U-shape, and that's something that, you know, we ought to consider when we're designing flies, for especially flies that are just, the mergers just underneath the surface, having that kind of a U-shape. That doesn't mean that we have to tie all of our flies that way, but, you know, the pupa will come up and attach itself to the underside of the surface of the water.
I know we'll talk later about actually fishing these different stages.
Yes.
There's different techniques, I'm sure, for each of these stages. In fact, your first chapter in your book is called Why Midges. Tell us why midges. Why are they so important?
Well, they're so very important in the fact that there is a great abundance of midges in the water. One of the things that we noticed, like fishing the San Juan, that's where Jerry and I first started what we call doing research. Actually, Jerry calls it, we were fishing, we didn't know we were doing research.
I was going to say, yeah, right, research. Yeah,
yeah. Right, research. And the thing that we noticed is that the pattern that we used the most were pupa-type patterns. And I think the reason for that is that the pupa is readily available to the trout in mass. There's millions of pupa ascending to the surface. And oftentimes, and Dr. Chan has talked to us about this, that oftentimes a trout will be in deeper water where they're more protected from predation from above. They may be in a water column where the current isn't very swift, and there's these millions of midge pupa ascending to the surface, and all the trout has to do is just stay in position, open its mouth, and capture all of these midge pupas as they're ascending to the surface. And because they are so minute, the trout has to eat tons and tons of them, if you will. And that's why I think the pupa is really, really important food source for the trout. And another reason why we're fishing midges is that the midges are in the water all year long, going through this process. And trout, especially trout on some of the tailwaters, and especially near, it seems to me in our observation, near dams where the water is colder, maybe some of the other types of insects like betis and caddis, the water may be too frigid for them, where the midges thrive, and the fish can eat them all year long. We know that in lakes that the trout could consume maybe 50% or more of the food source that they intake could be midges. And so midges are very, very important food source. I was kind of dismayed at first because I thought as I got older I'd be able to fish larger flies that I could see. And in fact, what Jerry and I found out when we started fishing some of these tailwaters is that we were having to go to smaller flies. But that also presented a very unique challenge to us that we readily accepted and wanted to learn how to do this and to become more successful. So we still consider ourselves students of midge fly fishing. We've learned quite a bit, which we've shared with you in the book, but we're also constantly learning. And we're very fortunate to fish with guys and know individuals like, say, Pat Dorsey, who's a phenomenal fly fisherman, Brian Yamauchi, who was our photographer, who's one of the finest fly tiers and fly fishermen I know. Jerry is very, very proficient nymph fisherman. In fact, Jerry's the one who kind of taught me how to nymph fish because I like dry flies and Jerry likes nymphs. And so it was really wonderful to go out there and learn. And we still think we're students of learning how to fish and fly fish. We certainly don't know everything, but we've learned quite a bit, and that's what we wanted to share with people in the book.
Sure, sure. Yeah. And we had Pat Dorsey on our show last show on fishing tailwaters. So
he's amazing.
If you guys missed that one, you want to go catch that one in the archive. Okay, we have some questions here, and we need to take a quick break here, but when we come back, okay. We'll be talking about flies here and specific patterns and so forth. So hang tight here, Rick. I'll be right back.
Will do.
Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk-wade and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. Located conveniently on US 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. We're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Rick Takahashi about midge secrets. If you'd like to ask Rick a question, go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And speaking of the questions, folks, we do get a lot of duplications or very similar questions, so you'll hear me try to group some things together. If I don't mention your name, I'm sorry, but we do have to do that for time purposes, so don't take it personally if I don't specifically mention your name and you've asked that question, okay? Now, before we jump back into those questions, Rick, tell us a little bit about what's been happening in your fly fishing world, both personally and, you know, commercially and so forth, and what's been going on?
Well, since Jerry and I have finished this book, and it's been published a couple of months ago, we have been spending every weekend going to various fly shops and various venues doing book signings, which we have found to be a lot of fun. We've made a lot of friends. We were at Laughing Grizzly a couple of weeks ago. We were at Rocky Mountain Anglers last Saturday. We're going to be at Jackson Loveland this Sunday. We are doing a author's book signing at the Blue Quill Angler up in Evergreen. And Jim Cannon and Pat Dorsey and Gary Okazaki, those guys that have been really, really supportive of our book. Jerry and I will be at the Denver Fly Show doing a book signing, and I will also be doing demonstration fly tying. We will be in New Mexico at the New Mexico Conclave. They've invited us to come up and do a presentation on midge fly fishing. And Jerry and I are very excited about going to New Mexico. And then we'll be visiting some other fly shops in the Colorado Springs area, Gillies.
Rick, we lost you.
Still there? Yeah, I am sorry. I don't know why this phone is doing that. I have a cord on. I'm not using one of those walk-around battery phones, so I don't know what's causing that. But then one of the other things that we're going to be doing is I'll be doing a fly tying demonstration at the West Denver Trout Unlimited Fly Tying Clinic.
Is that in February or something?
Yes, that's going to be, I think it's the second week in February.
That's something, if you're in the local Denver metro area, Colorado, or passing through at that time, that's a great thing to go to. That's probably, maybe, I don't know, 50, 75 tires there or something.
Oh, yeah, I think there was maybe 70 tires last year, and they're going to scale it back because not everybody had access to the tires. But there's excellent, excellent fly tires there.
Yeah. Now, tell people the name of your book again, and because we mentioned it in your intro, but we really haven't talked about it. Modern Midges, right?
Yeah, it's called Modern Midges, Tying and Fishing the World's Most Effective Patterns.
Okay.
It's published by Headwater Stackpole Books.
Good. You also teach fly tying classes, right?
Yeah, I do. I teach fly tying classes at Angler's Roost in Fort Collins, and I have for the past 7 years. It's something fun to do. I love to bring people to tying flies.
Do they have a website?
I love to tie flies. Yes, if you go to anglersroost.com.
Okay.
You can pick them up. There are several Angler's Roost, so put anglersroost.com for Collins, perhaps, and you'll get the right one.
Okay, great. Well, let's talk about some flies. And again, we've got lots of questions on this. So basically, we've got questions like from Rob in Longmont, Colorado, if you had to pick five midges, what would you pick? You know, what should I have in my box? What are the staples I should have in my box? And you know, what's a good all-around midge fly? What's your go-to midge fly? These are all questions we've got from different people. So maybe you can kind of walk us through this, because when you're talking about favorite midge, well, we've got to talk whether larva, pupa, adult, right?
Or
cluster. So,
Or if it's for river or still water, because the flies can be different in both the river and the in the lakes. That is an excellent question, Rob. It's hard for me to say what are my first five flies because there are so many wonderful patterns out there that either I've developed myself or Jerry's developed or other people have developed, and we love to fish them. But I guess if I had to pick just five flies, the flies that I would pick, for a larva, I would just do a red thread larva, which is just red thread tied onto like a 200R style hook, Tiemco hook. And then after you wrap the thread down, the hook shank, you just twist the bobbin to tighten up the weave, and then you wrap forward again to the eye using equally spaced wraps and creating a rib, and then just tying it off and putting real thin coat of the head cement. You don't want to use a heavy head cement. That's one of my favorite larva patterns, and I've not fished other patterns because that one has been so good for me. You can also tie one using white thread and coloring the thread in some of the various colors like light olive, tan, cream, and then just, again, doing the same thing. You can use midge tubing on it. Just so that you get that kind of segmented, long, wormy kind of an effect. So that's one thing that I would have is some larvas. And generally, Jerry and I have found that we like fishing larvas early in the morning, and usually later in the afternoon. We seem to find that that's when they are most active. And then during the midday, then we start going to midge pupas. And in a river, I like to use any one of the thread midge type pupas. I typically tie using sewing thread. I twist it up, and I like colors like black, brown, olive, tan, cream, but brown is probably one of my favorite colors to use. Brian Yamauchi's black fly larva is just a killer pattern. Brian has showed me how to tie those, and they're very, very effective for the rivers that all the rivers that we've been fishing. All around the state, we've caught fish with that fly. I like to use Dorsey's Black Beauty, usually in sizes 18 to 26. And most of the midges that I'm tying, I carry an assortment of midges, and they vary in size from 18 down to 26. So no matter what piece of water I go to, whether it be here in Colorado or in Montana or maybe even back east, I probably carry a very similar type of pattern, because I think midges are pretty much alike all over the world. And then another pattern I would carry is if I were fishing in both a lake and a river, is a mini bow tie buzzer or a bow tie buzzer. I have found great success. I like using the black body with maybe a silver holographic tinsel for the rib, or maybe blue holographic tinsel for the rib. And if you look in our book, we have that pattern. One of the very first patterns I fished was a crystal flash midge pupa, and that's a really good pattern to use in the rivers. Again, going back to Brian Yamauchi, he has a midge pupa, a coronamid pupa that he ties for the lakes. And I typically find the pupa in the lakes to be larger and longer than the ones that I've encountered in a river. And I like those in tan and olive and cream. And Brian's pattern is simply deadly. You have to look at it to appreciate the beauty of that fly and how well it's designed. And it's very realistic looking. And a lot of times I don't think realistic flies necessarily always work better than more impressionistic type of flies. I tie more impressionistic type of flies. But that's one fly that if I go to a lake and I've forgotten them, I'll turn around and go back and get them. And bring them back so that I can fish them. Another pattern that I think is good to carry is some type of a zebra midge pupa. And I like to have a midge pupa that has some contrast between the body color and the rib. And so you can do combinations like, you know, black with yellow thread or black with white thread or black with silver wire or gold wire. And I always try to, in my midge pupas, try to make a head a little bit larger, because that's what you generally find in the thorax and the head of the midge, that it's much larger in diameter than the abdomen. I also will carry some attractor type of midge pupas, like a disco midge. I have found that sometimes in higher water and when the water is off color, I can sometimes go to a larger style fly, and I will put an attractor to help attract the attention of the trout, and then drop off another pattern underneath that. And then finally, I guess I would use some kind of a dry fly, something like a Griffith's Gnat, or I have a pattern I call my high post midge adult. I find that to be really effective, and it's more of a cluster type of pattern where the midges have been trapped together, or they're done with their mating and they're trapped in the surface film in bunches. And trout know that there's food there, and they'll go and grab those. So, and you can oftentimes fish that in a little larger size pattern than, say, a size 26. You might be able to get away with a 18-20 because those masses are much, much larger in dimension than the individual flies themselves. But that's just a general rule. As far as the flies that I'm carrying, I have like 10 or 12 boxes filled with midges. And that's the one thing that I like about midges, is that you can tie up all different kinds of varieties of midges and colors and the materials that you use. And it's amazing how you can go out there and actually catch fish with them.
Yeah, Rick, you know, you had pointed me towards, you know, we were talking before we got the show started here, and I had mentioned I was looking at his book, and they've got a close-up of one of Pat Dorsey's midge boxes, and I said, wow, that's a lot of midges. I thought I had a lot. But I just, while you were talking, Rick, I was counting, I counted a row and then counted how many rows, and he's got 900 to 1,000 midges in that
yes.
that box. And then you told me you had 5 or 6 like that. I'm going, oh, my gosh, that's a lot of midges.
Yeah.
So to tie you down to just a handful here is quite the accomplishment, I think.
Well, it's nearly impossible, and my partner, Jerry, has quite a few patterns that he likes to fish that are different than the ones I have, and he's developed a couple of midge larvae that are just absolutely deadly. He has a little red rider that he's caught fish with when I couldn't catch fish. He's given me his rod, and I've gone and tried to fish with his rod and his flies in his run, and he'll go and he'd take my stuff and catch fish, you know, where I was fishing and couldn't catch fish. But he can catch fish with those things. And one time I was really distraught and was really getting upset because he was catching so many fish. I just told him if he valued our friendship, he wouldn't catch any more fish. But he kept catching fish. But when you look at, like, someone like Pat's box and you see all those flies, it's unbelievable how many different variations you can have, and that's what I think one of the joys for me of tying midges is that I can come up with all these different color combinations and go out and try them, and it's really fun.
Before I ask you a question about colors,
because
we do have some questions on colors, but I'm going to try to pin you down here. I'll let Russell from Fort Collins pin you down. But he said, Rick, if I only had one midge pattern to carry in my fly box, which would it be? And I'll expand that to say one larva pattern, one pupa, and one adult pattern. What would those three be if that's all you were allowed to take?
Great guy. And if I only had three flies to fish in each one of those, again, I go back to that original list that we talked about. I would have that red thread midge larva.
Right.
I would probably have a thread-bodied midge pupa, and for an adult,
color?
I like those in brown, primarily in brown. And the thread that I use to tie that is Coates and Clark Summer Brown 54A.
That makes a nice rib. Yeah.
That makes a wonderful rib, and you can view that fly on Fly Fisherman's website under Archive of Patterns. And type in my name, and you'll see the fly pattern there. And then if I just had the one adult, I would fish my high post black midge adult, which is very similar to a Griffith's gnat. I can see that on the water because I happen to be kind of short, too, and so I'm closer to the water. I can see that silhouetted against the water, and I've caught so many fish with that. If I had just those three patterns, I might start off with those three.
Okay, a couple of quick questions, then we'll talk about color. Don and Bozeman, it's probably Don Bishop, my friend, up there. Are midges or their larvae really as large as some of the imitation patterns suggest?
Excellent question, Don. In our experience, I have found that the midge larvae can be as... I tied basically the midge larvae in size 18 and 20, and sometimes I'll tie it down to 22, but I found the 18... to 20 to be about the size that I generally fish those patterns in a size 18 to 22. And I have found that as you go through the metamorphosis of the midge, you'll find that a lot of times the pupas are much larger than the adults. And on the lakes, we found some really large pupas, and the adults were a bit smaller than the pupa. And I imagine that occurs also in the river. And so that was an excellent question. And, yeah, I find that the larvae is a little bit larger than the actual size of the adult.
Okay. And then Jim in White Plains, New York, wants to know, what's your opinion on tying midges on up-eyed versus down-eyed or straight-eyed hooks?
You know, I used to have an opinion about that. I used to think that if I'm going to tie this really small fly, I would like to have as large a gape as possible in the hook, and that's the space between the shank and the point and the barb of the hook. And I've found that I will tie with all three of the hook styles. I'll tie some midge pupas on a Tianco 2488 hook. I might even go to a larger hook but tie the midge smaller so that there's a larger gape. I've not found that having a downturned eye or an upturned eye has made too much difference. I imagine there's some minuscule differences there, but I've had success on hooking fish with just about every style of eye. I used to think that the ring eye or the straight eye was the best hook for tying real small flies, and I don't necessarily feel that. I feel comfortable tying any of the midge patterns I tie on a variety of different style of hooks.
Okay. We have this is a question on the internet that's come in. Ken Barr in Whitehall, Montana says, what is your favorite material for trailing shuck on a midge emerger? For example, if you were using a scud hook, what would you choose?
Well, if I were doing a trailing shuck, what I'd like to use is very, very, very sparse antron fibers. And I often take kind of an amber color antron and pull out maybe 6 to 8 fibers for the trailing shuck. A lot of the commercial patterns that I've seen seem to me to have too thick of shuck, and I like to have that chitinous appearance to the shuck that's very minimal. You can see through it. And so I try to minimize the amount of material that I put on for a shuck, but I think for my overall favorite material would probably be antron fibers.
Okay. Another question from the internet. Ryan in Bakersfield, California. Do you prefer bead heads or not?
You know what? I use both. Bead heads and non-bead heads. When bead heads first became popular, I was very resistant to fishing bead head flies. I said, well, what is this, you know, and I just wasn't very well educated. And then I started fishing patterns that had bead heads both in glass and metal beads, and I think in many instances that glass bead or that metal bead is very good at giving the impression of that gaseous bubble that we talked about earlier, that the pupas will flake their bodies with as they ascend to the surface. So I think that they're important. I tie them both with beads and without beads.
He also had a second part of a question, which I didn't read.
Sure.
But the second part was, if you do use beads, which you do, what colors do you use?
Well, I've been influenced a lot by Pat Dorsey's work in using the mercury beads, because I believe that some of the samples that we've gathered, you've seen that silvery kind of a reflection, and I try to mimic that. And I think that the clear mercury bead with that silver lining is an excellent bead. I also will use red beads a lot in some of the pupas and some of the larvae to add some color to the fly, maybe add some bulk to the head. But I'll be honest with you, if you come down to my fly tying studio, you'll see probably 50 different colors of beads that I will use. It's just what hits my fancy, and sometimes if I have a particular color scheme, I will try to keep all the colors in that same family, so I might pick a bead that goes along with that particular color scheme.
Okay, good.
I hope that answers that satisfactorily.
Yeah, I think that's great. Yeah.
Okay.
Let's talk about colors, because we do have some questions here on colors. Gary Nelson in Falls City, Nebraska. He mm-hmm. says, is color important when tying and using small midge pupa type flies like the zebra midge? Then we've got some other, you know, Matt in Oklahoma wanted to know, you know, how would you rank color, size, texture, and rib contrast? So can you kind of address your thoughts on color and contrast?
Yeah. Some information that I've read, and I've seen both sides of the story where they say, well, trout can't see colors and trout do see colors. I believe, in my belief, I guess maybe being an artist, that I believe that trout see colors. And so, because I have tied patterns where maybe I'm using a black pattern, I'm not catching a fish, I'll switch it to a red or a blue or cream, and I start catching fish. And go figure, you know, using the same pattern, the same kind of configuration, same size. But the fish seem to know the difference, and they will take a particular color. I have been fishing so many times where one day they're taking one color, the next day you go back and say, I've got this dialed in, I'm going to fish this color. And they won't take that color. They'll want something different. And so, that's one of those things that we're still learning about, you know, when the fish, what color, when. But I generally will stick to more of the natural brown shades, because some of the pupas that I've collected are those colors. So I try to mimic the color as well as I can. And the second part of your question about what's more important, size, shape, color, all of those are important. But I think one of the first things that I try to determine is what part of the life cycle is the fish keen on? Is it a larva? Is it a pupa? Is it an adult? Is it an emerger? What is it? Then I'll try to mimic the size. I think size is really important because I found that when I went down to the San Juan, I thought I was tying small flies when I first went down. And they were size 18 and 20. And you know what? Those flies are way too large. I find that I had to start between 22 to 26 to be more consistent in hooking at the fish. So I think that size is the second factor that you should really pay close attention to. And then color is maybe the third criteria. And I still am a great believer in presentation being one of the most important factors of catching fish, is to being able to affect that drag-free drift to the fish. You're going to increase your opportunities of hooking that fish because it's mimicking the natural movement of the pupa in the water.
Okay, we had a couple of One question from Steve in Vienna, Austria. Vienna, Austria. Steve, it's got to be 3-4 in the morning there. Thanks for listening. So he says, I thought chironomids only live in still waters. I'm surprised to learn that they also live in streams. Are these?
Yes. Well, you know, when we first started investigating midges and finding out, well, what are the correct names? I think one thing that we found, and we find that here in the United States, I think with some people, is that they associate the chironomid as being a lake insect and midges being a river insect, but they're both chironomids. And so, we're trying to educate people that, yeah, the midges they're called chironomids, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they're from a lake, that chironomids are in rivers and in still water.
He asked the second part of his question. He says, are those slow little oxygenated? That's not, I don't know if that's a word or not.
I would probably say it the same way. Oxygenated, yeah.
Yeah, is that, I guess what he's thinking is that, hey, these chironomids are living in lakes where there's not a lot of oxygen down there in that silt layer.
Right.
Do they need that same kind of environment to live in a stream?
I think that that's a very good question. I don't know if I know the answer completely, but I'm just going to venture a guess. And I would say that, at least from our experience and some of this, The tailwaters that we fish, and as Pat outlined in his book, that environment where they have a silty bottom is an ideal area for midges to occur. And we know that midges occur in all water types throughout the world. I was talking to Jerry this evening prior to calling you, and he was talking about that they found midges in the Arctic, and they found midges in really, really hot areas. And so, you know, I think midges can tolerate a wide variety. And so I think, you know, it's very possible that they don't necessarily need to have that silt environment. I think they need to have an environment where they can build their cases to pupate in.
Midges probably get along well with carp, who can live just about anywhere, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, we need to take a quick break here, Rick. So okay. When we come back, we'll talk more about flies and midges here. Keeney's okay. Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com. K-I-E-N-E.com. Or call Keeney's Fly Shop at 1-800-400-0359. That's 800-400-0359. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Rick Takahashi about midge secrets. If you'd like to ask Rick a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, I have a question for you, Rick, about, okay. You know, we've talked a bit about color, and I'm looking at Pat Dorsey's box, and I'm I'm seeing a lot of browns, blacks, creams, reds, some grays. But, you know, when we talk about other insects and matching the hatch, it seems like we are a lot more concerned about color than we are with midges, like with mayflies and so forth. Am I off base there, or do midges really come in all these colors, or are we just, you know, trying to wake them up with a red one when they've been looking at browns all day, or don't we know?
That is the $64,000 question.
Okay.
In our conversations with entomologists, we have found that midges come in a variety of colors. They have the whole color spectrum, so to speak. And so, you know, they're not like, I would think, something like a betis that have that olive kind of a tinge of grayish kind of a color pattern to them. Midges, we've found them in all different kinds of colors, and we've tried some pretty radical color combinations. If you look at Pat's box, he's got some that are yellow, too, in kind of a peach color. You know, I think it's safe to say that you could tie midges in a whole variety of shades of color and be successful with them. That's one thing I have noticed about midges is that there are a lot of different colors. And you know what? That's one of the things that makes at least fly tying for me so much fun is that I can try all of these different color combinations and to see if they will catch fish. And you will be surprised how often you will catch fish with a whole host of a variety of colors. You know, we've been playing around, Jerry and I have been playing around with tying some midges in blue and having some very good success with catching fish in the blue color range. And I've been told that blue is one of the last colors that a trout sees in the water. So that question about do trout see colors? I guess they do because they can see that blue.
Yeah.
And we've caught a lot of fish with them. But
yeah,
That's what makes the fly tying so much fun. If you look at Greg Garcia's Rojo midge, he has a whole plethora of different colors and different color beads, you know, for his fly. If you look at Charlie Craven's flies, his jujubes, and he has a whole range of colors. And that's what makes this particular style of fishing so much fun is that, you know, try the different colors. You'll be surprised sometimes at how well they work.
I'm going to read this from Greg Lucas in San Diego, kind of sums it up here. He says, what is the best way to determine colors of midge patterns? For example, I was fishing the East Walker in the Sierras, and I was getting a few grabs on a number 18 black with a copper wire wrap. But then I switched to a black with silver wire, and it was game on. And to be honest, the only reason I switched was the last one wrapped with copper. What made the fish like the silver over copper? And I think you just sum that up and says, you know, we don't know. Go figure, right?
Yeah, and that's exactly it. I mean, as I mentioned before, we've been fishing the same run the next day, and the fish are taking a different color.
Yeah.
And I can't figure that. I don't understand why they do that. That's why I have to carry so many flies, so that I can try these different combinations to see if they'll work.
Now, Brian in Wisconsin asked about a favorite color, and I think you kind of answered that already. Didn't you say that brown is one of your
patterns? The pupa. Yeah. Brown is, you know, the natural colors, you know, those brown colors, tan, I really rely heavily on, you know, in the larva, the red, cream, it seems to be, you know, for me. So, yeah, it's that those natural colors that seem to work well for me.
Last question on tying here. Jeff in Chilliwack, British Columbia asks, what type of vise do you use, and do you use midge jaws?
I tie on a variety of vices, and I've been very, very fortunate to have been able to obtain some really outstanding vices. The three vices that I tie on, and I like to interchange them, is that I'm tying on a CFT9000 vice, which is CNF's vice. It's a wonderful, wonderful vice to tie on. And it comes with a standard jaw, and I've been able to tie really, really small flies, up to 26, 30 on that vise. I also tie on a Renzetti Master vise, which a friend of mine made me an offer I couldn't refuse on it. And I love tying on that vise. And no, I don't have a midge jaw on that, but you can get midge jaws for for some of these, but I've found that some of the devices you really don't need if you're really careful. You place the hook and you don't necessarily need them, but on other devices, yeah, I would recommend getting a midge jaw, especially for the really diminutive size hooks. And then another vise that I tie on quite a bit is a peak vise. It's a vise that's from Loveland, manufactured here, and it's a really great vise for the money. And then I also have in my possession a law vise, which is a very, very fine instrument that's made in England, and it's quite expensive, but it's really a delight to tie on. So I like to tie on a variety of different vices. Yeah.
Okay.
And all of them, by the way, have that rotary kind of function, and I don't use the rotary so much as to turn the fly around and look at the fly from all different angles.
Yeah, yeah. Another question from Steve in Vienna, on him, because he's talking about small flies. He says, are sizes smaller than 20 or 22 really necessary if I want to fish midges? They are so hard to tie, and he has a smiley in there. So.
I agree with him. I think they're harder to tie. In fact, when I'm tying, I also use a giraffe magnifying glass so that I can see the fly a little bit easier. And I'm getting some new eyeballs here at the end of the month, so I'll be able to tie a little bit better. So I'm really excited about that. I find that there are times, like on the San Juan, that, yeah, you do need to go down to a smaller fly if you want to catch the fish more consistently. I've seen fish refuse a fly that was tied a little bit larger, but take the dropper that I tied in a smaller size. I've seen that happen on any numerous occasions. So, yeah, there are times when that size does matter. And I think on some of the pressured tailwaters, I think if you read Pat's book, he will probably say the same thing. I haven't got to read everything that Pat Dorsey put in his book, but he's such a great fisherman and knowledgeable and very observant person, and I think he would tell you, yeah, you've got to carry a variety of those sizes if you want to fool the greatest number of fish. So I carry flies typically in midges from 18 to 26. And so, yeah, I think it's important.
We've got a couple questions here on equipment and then a whole bunch on rigging here. Don McLean in Calgary, Alberta, wants to know if there's any particular rods you use for mid-fishing or do you just go with your standard trout rod? And then also Don Daly in Clarksville, Tennessee, asks, do you use different equipment for still versus moving water?
Oh, excellent questions. There are a number of rod manufacturers out there who make excellent fly rods. The things that I'm looking for in a midge fishing rod, first of all, is a rod that is between 8.5, say, and 9.5 feet in length, because I'm a rather short person, and having that extra rod length helps me to mend and to control the line so much easier. I like to typically, when I'm fishing in a lot of tailwaters, I like to use a 3, or from a 2 to a 4 weight fly rod. If I get into larger rivers, like say out west here, Gray Reef or the North Platte, I may opt to go with a 5, maybe 6 weight rod for handling larger fish and in swifter water. I tend to like a fly rod that will protect light tippets, and the rods that I typically like to fish with are Winston fly rods and Sage fly rods. I fish with the Winston B2X. I fish with the old Winston IM6 fly rods because they have a softer tip, and I feel like I can play the fish more successfully with that. I love fishing even sometimes a medium fast action rod like an XP or an SLT Sage rod. I think are excellent rods, but you know what? You don't have to buy those really expensive rods. I just happen to be in a position where I was able to get them at a reasonable price. But I think if you look for a fly rod that you feel comfortable in fishing with, and maybe one that will have a little softer tip, might help you land the fish a little bit easier. If you're looking for a rod that you want to pinpoint, you might go with a faster action rod. But I often will like that slower action rod with a softer tip like the B2X to help me fight the fish.
All right, let's talk about rigging. And let's just talk about for streams right now. We'll try to hit some still water here if we have time. Questions about leader setups and, you know, John Wainwright and Cabin John, Maryland, asked about fishing multiple midges on the same leader. So tell us about your, and we do have a whole bunch of questions here about two-fly rigs, and so I'm going to let you just kind of address them all and talk about your philosophy on a two-fly rig, whether it's, you know, dry and dropper or double wet droppers or however you do it. And give us your insights there.
Well, this is my preference, and I think that you can talk to a whole group of fishermen and get some different opinions on this. But when I'm generally nymph fishing, I would say about 80 to 90% of the time I'm fishing a two-fly rig as a nymph rig that is below the surface of the water. And typically the way that I set up my rig is that I like to use a 7.5 4X leader, a tapered leader. I like to have my leader, at least in a river, maybe not about the same length as maybe the fly rod. It just helps me to control the line a little bit better. To that 4X leader, I will put on about 15 to 18 inches of 5X tippet. And the reason I do that is that sometimes if I need to change to a dry fly, I've already started to decrease the size of the tippet, and I can, on the 5X tippet, I can add 6X tippet to a longer length and maybe 7X if I need it. But typically when I'm fishing a nymph rig, I will add 10 to 12 inches of 6X tippet to the 5X. At the junction of the 5 and 6X tippet is usually where I place my weight. And then I tie on the fly using like a clinch knot or a pinson knot. And then in a river, I always tie off the dropper off the eye of the point fly instead of the bend of the hook. And I'll go another 10 to 12 inches. I try to keep that 10 to 12 inches constant. It's a setup that I learned on the San Juan River. And then I'll put my dropper fly. And then I like to put, if I'm using a strike indicator, I like to put the strike indicator between 1 and 1.5 times the depth of the water. And that's all because I like to fish slower, more technical kinds of water. If I'm fishing faster currents, I will adjust the weight and maybe where I place the strike indicator, I might put it further up the line because of the speed of the current. In lake fishing, I use long leaders. For the majority of my fishing, I generally fish with a floating fly line in both instances and just use long leaders in the still water. And I'll sometimes fish as large as a 3X leader, you know, maybe a 10, 12-foot 3X leader. And then I either put another length of 3X or 4X tippet on. And then I'll tie on the first the point fly. And then oftentimes, because I'm pulling the fly towards me in the water, a lot of times in still water fishing, I will tie off the bend of the hook. But Brian Yamauchi, our photographer, is deadly with the technique of where he will tie off the eye of the hook off the point, the dropper fly off the eye of the hook, and extend it down 12, maybe 18 inches and put another fly. And then sometimes he will just use those flies and put what we call a slip strike indicator, an indicator that will slide up and down the line when you've hooked the fish. And sometimes he's been teaching me to fish 3 to 5 feet underneath the water, no weight on the flies. Just use the weight of the flies and fish out there, cast out, and let it sit there and move it very, very slowly. Catch a lot of fish that way.
Now, when you're you were just talking about still water fishing there. Going back to stream fishing, is your point fly usually pupa and your fly above that?
Excellent question.
I mean, point fly a larva and the pupa above it? Or?
Excellent question. And we address a lot of these things in our book, Jerry and I did. In the morning when we're fishing a tailwater, we will, because we find that a lot of times the larvae, at least we've found that the larvae are more active in the morning and in the later afternoon, is that we will put a larva on as the point fly and then put a pupa and drop a pupa off the larva. And the reason that we do that is that the weight as it goes to the level, desired level that you have to wait for, is that you will find that the larva is closer to the bottom of the run of the river, and that the hydraulics will oftentimes push that pupa up into the water column a little bit. So in the morning, early morning to mid-morning, we will definitely put the larva on. Sometimes we'll put a couple of larva on. Then as it gets towards mid-morning, afternoon, we might switch to using two pupas. And we always, when we are fishing, we always adjust the weight and where we position the strike indicator, even if we move just a few feet up the river. We are constantly changing, and that's one thing that I think is a real important factor is to change up all the time. Don't just set up one rig and go fish all day the same rig, because every time you move to a new spot, you may have a different type of circumstances as far as the depth and the flow of the water. And so you need to oftentimes change the weight of that you're using, the length of the strike indicator. And those are important factors. And that's one thing that we had to learn, because we were one of those guys who would rig up in the parking lot and then go fish all day and then wonder why we didn't catch any fish. Mm-hmm. So you have to always kind of change up on tactics.
Well, given what you just said, Paul in Moscow, Idaho, mm-hmm. asks, are midges more effective fished alone or as droppers off a dry fly? Do you ever use a dry fly, a hopper or anything?
That is an excellent question, and that is a very, very effective way of fishing a dry dropper. Sometimes you will fish over fish that are very sensitive to strike indicators. And so if you can use a larger dry fly and then drop the midge off the fly, that can be a deadly, deadly combination. I will fish that way if I remember to try it. I get sometimes stuck in my way, I'll just fish that two-fly rig as a nymph. But, boy, fishing a dry dropper is a deadly combination. Charlie Craven has made money fishing a dry dropper, and sometimes he'll do a dry dropper. And that's a very, very effective method. I should try it more often. In my older age, I'm getting a little bit more lazy in trying to fish that particular technique. But it's a very, very effective technique, and it's an excellent question.
Yeah, I had good success with that. In fact, down on the San Juan River, as it was getting to dusk and hard to see, and I was fishing some of this kind of fishing the banks along the San Juan down there. And there was a lot of hatch activity with midges and so forth, a lot of rises. And so I started fishing, a Griffith's Gnat as my dry fly with a pupa dropper, and I was getting hits on both of them. It was kind of hard for me to tell whether are they taking the emerging insects, or are they taking the adults, or what, and it was kind of hard to see. So I used that, and that proved to be, with only about an 8-inch dropper off the dry fly,
And it
proved to be quite effective.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you a little technique that we've used on the San Juan is that when the betas are hatching, sometimes we'll put a large Chernobyl ant and then drop a midge off that, and wherever the fish rose to the betas, we'll flop down real hard the Chernobyl ant, and oftentimes the fish just turn around and grab this huge Chernobyl ant, where they're generally taking these very diminutive flies. They'll sometimes take a bigger fly, and a friend of mine, a guy down there, Bubba Smith, and Bear Good, I was fishing with them last year, and they were using like a bar slump buster and then dropping a midge off that, and unbelievably productive. So using a larger fly in that dropper can be very effective.
Question here from Walton, Redding, California, and I think you might have said this, but you said it kind of fast. I didn't catch it anyways. When you're tying on the tippet section for the point fly, do you tie on an improved clinch knot, or do you use a loop knot?
I would say that 95% of the time I use a clinch knot. And if I usually get so excited about fishing that I just want to tie the knot and get the fly on and the fly in the water, because if the fly's not in the water, you're not going to catch fish. But I'll tell you what, doing that like a non-slip loop knot can be very effective, because that allows the fly to swing in the water. And sometimes if I would take my time and tie that the non-slip knot, it's a very effective. In fact, a friend of mine, Jeff Allard, who has a guide business up in the Winter Park area, Fraser area, he also ties his dropper off by tying a clinch knot on the leader that goes to the point fly. and then ties on his leader, and then he can slide it up and down the line, and then he puts his dropper off that. And so if he wants to change up his point fly, it's very simple, just to slide the line up, tie on a new point fly, slide the line back down, and it's ready to go.
Bill in Nazareth, Pennsylvania wants to know, if you do use indicators, what kind do you use?
Well, that is also an excellent question. Lately, for the past several years, I have really come to like using Spirit River's hothead strike indicator. And what I do, I use it a little bit different, I think, than most people. A lot of times it has a little O-ring. It's a round foam cylinder with an O-ring on the bottom. And usually a multicolored strike indicator, green, yellow, green, or yellow, red, black, yellow, kinds of combinations, and they really ride high in the water. What I often do is we'll loop the line, pass it through the O-ring, and then pull that loop over the strike indicator, and then as you start to cinch it down, I don't cinch it down. What I do is I will grab both ends of the leader and just pull it real tight, and what that does is it inverts that O-ring into kind of like a half figure eight, if that's a word. But what I find is that I can slide that strike indicator up and down the line. And so, you know, I had mentioned earlier that it's good to change the position of the strike indicator as you approach different types of water. I like using that strike indicator. I also like to use a technique that Pat Dorsey showed me, and that was using a little dental rubber band and making the loop and wrapping the rubber band and then putting the polypropylene yarn and then pulling all that tight, and it creates a real light yarn strike indicator. One of Jerry's favorite techniques is sometimes to use the Pulsa strike indicators, and he'll use two of them and he'll space them apart. And what he does is he'll cast quartering upstream, throwing upstream, and then try to align the two strike indicators, and he'll watch as those are drifting down, and he'll watch the first strike indicator. And oftentimes, if that moves, that's a fish. And Jerry will raise a rod, and he's caught many fish that way. It took a little while for him to get used to that very subtle movement of the strike indicator, but that's worked really well. Gray Reef, we sometimes use little black balloons where we just put a puff of air, put an overhand knot, and tie that onto our leaders. And it's fairly easy to cast, but you can really see it well in the water, and it's very, very sensitive to take. So we take very subtle takes. But the one thing that I think that I've learned, the most important factor of using a strike indicator is to realize, and I think Pat talks about this, imagine that there's nothing underneath that water that's going to impede your strike indicator except the fish. And so every time your strike indicator pauses, jumps, does twists, does something different, it doesn't have to go underneath the water, which for many years I was waiting for it to go underneath the water before I struck, missed a lot of fish. That a lot of times that's a fish taking the fly. And if you can watch those subtle movements and raise your rod tip gently when you see something that impedes that strike indicator, there'll be a fish on. So I think that's one of the things that took me a while to learn. I used to wait until the strike indicator went in the water and missed a lot of fish.
Okay, let's talk a little bit, because we're running out of time here, about strategies and tactics. And again, I'm going to lump a bunch of these questions together, because we had so many tonight. Thomas Sipe in Western Pennsylvania says, what size and pattern would you use on unknown waters? And I'm just going to kind of expand that question and say, if you're walking up to a stream, let's stick with streams here. If you're walking up to a stream and you haven't fished it before, how do you determine where to start, you know, in your midge box? You've talked about morning, you know, later in the day and how you change up for the different life cycles, but what do you go to first in that box of 1,000 midges?
Well, you know what? It very much goes to back what we were talking about in the morning. I will most likely, I rig up the same rig that I explained to you in almost all the waters I fish, whether they're here or there. I use the same thing. I will in the morning follow the same kind of routine, just because that's what I've witnessed in so many different streams, is that I'll put on that larva and then that pupa, and then really watch what's going on. If I see a lot of midges starting to hatch, I might just start going to an emerger and a pupa, you know, and start fishing higher up in the water column. So I have to do a lot of observation. And then, you know, when it comes right down to it, a lot of it is just guesswork. You know, you're just going to try to give it your best shot there. But I think if we can observe the water and, you know, a lot of times we don't get right in the water. We'll just sit there and watch. And sometimes you can see the midges in the water if you're very, very careful. But I would just follow this pretty much the same type of tactics as I do on the tailwaters here, is I'll use that kind of a setup and then go through a progression of changing flies until I start connecting with fish.
Now, we make it sound like that's all you do is fish midges, but I know you don't. Doug McLean in Calgary, Alberta asks that, do you go out specifically looking to fish midge hatches, or do you just fish them as you find them? In other words, when the opportunity
comes. You know, I'm a student of fly fishing and trying to learn how to catch fish, and I still struggle with that at times. I try to fish what I'm observing. If I get to a river and I'm looking and I see a lot of midge activities, you can bet that one of the flies that I'm going to put on is a midge pattern. And one of my favorite searching midge patterns is a mini bowtie buzzer. And I've caught a lot of fish with that. And then I'll put, like if it's in the season that you might have betis hatches, I'll put on a nymph. You know, or maybe I'll put on a grasshopper and then drop a midge off that. So, yeah, I don't just always go and just fish midges and by golly, that's all I'm going to fish. I am more interested in catching fish. And if I could be like my co-author and fishing partner, be like Jerry and catch more fish. I don't catch as many fish as Jerry. He's just too good. And he catches bigger fish than I do. I've gotten so used to it. You know, I just like watching people fish and really good fishermen fish, and it's really fun. Like watching my friend Brian Yamauchi. You know, I dress the same as he does. I have the same kind of rod. I use his flies.
And borrowed his socks, I bet, too, huh?
If that would help, I would borrow his socks, too.
Well, unfortunately, we're running out of time here, but let me just throw one last thing in here
okay.
For the folks in the East, because they're asking, and again, I'm just going to kind of group these together. We got Joe, John, and Jack all out in the East Coast asking
yes.
about, you know, that your book was done on a lot of Western rivers and patterns and so forth, but what's your take on using a lot of these same patterns and so forth on the East Coast, and will they work out there, do you think?
Yes, you know, in fact, one of our goals that Jerry and I set out when we decided to write this book on midges is that we didn't want it to be just a Western midge pattern book. We have gotten flies from all over the world. We have asked people from all over the world. I think Jerry told me that there was maybe over 8 different countries represented in our book. We don't know how many different states are represented. We certainly have fly tires from back east send us flies from all parts and all points on the compass. And so, you know, I think our thinking was that midges are midges, and they're pretty much the same all over the world. And so I think that these patterns can be effective all over the world, not just the West here, although, you know, there's been a large concentration of development of midge patterns out west here because we have some excellent tailwaters, as Pat aptly notes in his book on tailwaters, that these patterns, I think, would work anywhere. I'd feel comfortable going anywhere and fishing these patterns.
Okay, we're going to squeeze one last question in here
okay.
because we obviously didn't talk about it, and your partner in midge fishing out there, Jerry, sent in a question on the Internet. He says, Rick, what tippet material is? He just wants to make sure we cover everything properly here. He's watching out for you, Rick. He wants to know what tippet material is best for midge fishing, monofilament or fluorocarbon, and why.
Jerry is a very, very wealthy old man who drives a Porsche, and he likes to fish with fluorocarbon. And he really does. He's very, very successful at fishing with fluorocarbon. I am more the Volkswagen kind of income, and so I like, and not nothing wrong with the Volkswagen, please, or Toyota, I should say. I like using monofilament, and the reason that I like monofilament is that I feel that it's much more supple than fluorocarbon. And I, to be honest with you, I haven't really given fluorocarbon a fair shake. I think probably because of the expense. Jerry's has spools and spools of it. I only have one spool of it that he gave me.
Probably has a whole trunk full of it in his Porsche, right?
Oh, yes. He does. And so, but Jerry is very successful with fluorocarbon. But I use, I must say that I do use both. I do carry both.
Okay, yes. Great. Well, thanks, Jerry, for keeping us on track there and creating a bit of controversy, which is always fun. but unfortunately, we're out of time and we can't talk anymore, so we need to wrap things up here. But stick with us. We've got a few more things to do here. And one is that we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. And we'll also be giving away a copy of Rick's latest book, Modern Midges, Rick and Jerry's book, courtesy of Stackpole Books. So when we return, we'll be doing just that, giving away those prizes. A mining company called Pac Rim Coal is planning a massive strip mine near Anchorage, Alaska. The Chuitno Coal Project would be the first project in Alaska history to mine directly through salmon habitat, the Chuitno River drainage, 11 of it. Critical commercial, sport, and subsistence fishing economies would be permanently destroyed. Pac Rim says they can rebuild the salmon stream, but scientific experts can find no example where success restoration has occurred after strip mining. Chuitno Coal would be shipped to Asia, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon runs. It's time to stop the Chuitno Coal strip mine. If you'd like to help with that, for more information, go to www.inletkeeper.org. That's inletkeeper.org or www.trustees.org, and you can learn more about that situation. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find our link on our homepage in the section for tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave us your comments. We truly appreciate it. And now, it's time to give away our prizes. So the winners for these drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database, and if you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late, but make sure that you do so for our next show because we're always giving away some great prizes. If you are the lucky winner tonight, we'll contact you after the show and provide you with the information on how to receive your prize. So first, we'll be giving away that 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. To learn more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. A great organization to be a part of and to help promote fly fishing around the world. So I'm going to press my button here and get my random selection, and it's Mike McCracken in Ohio. Mike McCracken in Ohio. So congratulations, Mike. I know you'll like that membership if you don't have one. If you do, we'll get yours extended for you. And now we'll give away that 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. And Fly Fusion Magazine comes out of Calgary, Canada. You want to learn more about it? Flyfusionmag.com. www.flyfusionmag.com. Great, beautiful magazine that you always learn things from. And our winner there is Pete Brubaker. Pete Brubaker. Congratulations, Pete. Pete's in Kansas. So enjoy, gentlemen, your prizes, and I'm sure you will. And congratulations. Okay, now, Rick, I have to come up with a question. And these guys are really good out here. They usually anticipate my questions, so it's kind of tough sometimes to stump them. But in fact, I've never stumped them, to be honest with you. They've always come up with the right answer. I'm clearing my cue here, and I'm going to ask them a question. And Rick, I want you to verify whether they give the right answer or not. First person to put that in, along with their name and their location, using that text box on our homepage, will win Rick's book. And this is definitely a book that you'd like to have in your collection, I guarantee you. So the question is, what is Rick's favorite bead called? When he ties beadhead flies, what's his favorite bead called? Okay, first answer, Rick, is a drag feet free drift. I don't think so.
Nice try. Nope. That's important.
We got another one, glass bead. I don't think so, do you?
Getting closer.
Getting closer, okay. Bead color to match the fly. You did say that, but that wasn't your first choice, was it?
No.
No. Well, Here we go. I think we got it. Jeremy in Boulder, Colorado says Mercury.
Jeremy, you are correct.
Well, congratulations, Jeremy. You just got Rick's book, and you're close enough. You could probably get him to sign it sometime at one of his fly tying demonstrations. So, Jeremy, what you need to do is send me your name, of course, and your address, phone number, email address. You can do so in the same box that you answered the question in, or you can send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com. info@askaboutflyfishing.com. Give us your information, and then we'll have that book shipped out directly from Stackpole to you. So congratulations, Jeremy. Boy, they didn't get it the first time around this time. It must have been a little harder question. But
good question.
But we got a winner. That's what the important thing is. Well, hey, Rick, thanks for being with us tonight. We really appreciate you being on the show. It was a pleasure to talk with you. And you wouldn't think you could talk an hour and a half just about midges, but we did, and we still have pages worth of questions here. So,
yes.
But I think we did a good job, and I sure enjoyed talking to you.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me onto your show.
Well, great. Well, I'm sure I'll see you around here since we're locals, and see each other soon. Our next broadcast will be on December 2nd, and that's next week. So it's going to be 7 p.m. or 9 p.m. Eastern. On that show, we're going to interview Bill Butts, and our topic for the show will be wild white bass. Bill loves white bass. They're hard-hitting and put on a tough fight. So we're going to find out from Bill what it takes to catch these great freshwater sport fish on a fly. We'd also like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Royal Gorge Anglers, and Keeney's Fly Shop for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-888-961-1115, extension 2. We'll be happy to explain the options to you. That's, again, 888-961-1115, extension 2. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.